meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Alexis Moore is a victims advocate, and she's an expert in matters pertaining to high-tech stalking and cyber-stalking. She's a part of the group of Survivors in Action. Susan Rhodes is a victim. This is a story, again, that a lot of people will sit back when they hear it and say, oh, come on, you mean this stuff actually happens? It does. Call it the blue wall. Call it whatever you want. Call it a failure in judicial bias in Solano County, California. Anyway, regardless, I want to welcome both of these ladies to the program tonight. Hi, Alexis. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Dana.
Hello, Dana.
The story is... Well, we'll get into the story here in a minute, but it's not the only story. We've covered stories like this before. Victims of law enforcement husbands, judicial bias in the courts, domestic violence, you name it. I want to start with Alexis. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Survivors in Action, and how you came to start helping Susan.
Certainly. Hi, Dana, and hi, audience. Basically, back in August of 2008, I accept referrals quite a bit through various crime victims organizations as well as through the various folks that administer the Federal Identity Change Program. And in August of 2008, Crime Victims United here in California referred Ms. Rhodes to me. She's a high-tech stalking victim, and also as we progressed along and I became more familiar with her case, I realized that there was, in fact, definitely some problems in regards to the judicial system and, in particular, bias that was occurring because of the fact that her abusive ex-husband, or now ex-husband, was a member of law enforcement. I didn't quite understand all of it, per se. I believe the system had some sort of checks and balances, and after becoming more acquainted with Susan and her case and helping her, being her advocate and reaching out for help on her behalf, I became quite aware of the dire need for victims who are involved as officer-involved victims, either sexual assault, stalking, or domestic violence. Again, you know, there's many victims out there, and they can tell you that it's tough enough to be a domestic violence victim, which I am, and also a high-tech stalking victim. However, when you add that officer involved into the equation, and then you add into the courts, there is definitely some injustice going on in many parts of the state and across the nation. And now that I've advocated on Susan's behalf, I've become more personally involved and realized that it's a lot more serious than what I ever even imagined. So my background, just in a nutshell, is prior to meeting with Susan and becoming an advocate, I was a high-tech investigator. I worked with one of the nation's largest high-tech firms, locating people and assets and doing background checks across the nation and the world. And it just so happened that I involved myself with a partner that ended up being abusive and became a cyber stalker. So in essence, although I thought it would be difficult to leave this particular individual, I had no idea after I left how difficult it would be, and that there were not adequate protections for cyber-stalking and high-tech stalking victims out there. I mean, when I first reported back in 2004 various incidents involving high-tech, it basically threw everybody for a loop, including law enforcement and the prosecutors. They said, wow, you know, we're not familiar with this, or in essence, they said I was crazy. So ultimately, rather than going out and putting my hands in my head and saying, wow, there's no help, I said, I've got to do something, and I vowed to make a difference, and by doing so, it's by starting Survivors in Action and advocating for victims of crime in regards to high-tech. Being that I was once on the other side of the fence as a high-tech investigator, and now I've become a victims advocate specializing in cyber-stalking crime.
it's so important to have my audience and everyone else is out there educated in the fact that, you know, the internet and high tech isn't just sitting down and scrolling through and looking and maybe, you know, your cell phone and your BlackBerry and all that sort of stuff. There's a lot of evil things that can be done with it. Susan Rhodes, as the victim in this case, there's a huge perspective here that we can look at, both from being a victim, your ex-law enforcement, right down to the fact that it's bad enough being a victim. When you call for help, those that help you, you don't know if they're going to help you because of some sort of allegiance to your ex, right down to the fact that I'm sure you never thought of being a victim of high-tech stalking. Tell us a little bit about your story.
Thank you for having me on the show, Dana. My story is fairly, I'd like to say it's unusual, but I have heard other stories similar to mine. But my ex-husband is a very highly respected officer in the domestic violence arena, not only within the state of California, but within our nation, training judges on domestic violence. And he has training at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, in stalking. So he's a very skilled, highly trained, highly respected person. So it didn't really surprise me when I started getting into my situation, trying to survive this, that, you know, I realized how quickly he was protected by everyone that I would try to reach out to for help. So basically, I have two parts. There's two parts of the story. There's the judicial bias, and then there's also this stalking with the high tech, using high, you know, the technology that he's able to use, which is primarily, you know, what happened to me was I was a high school teacher teaching special ed students. My ex-husband became violent with me. I ended up in the hospital. He filed for divorce, and I took out some protective orders along the way. He started threatening my life by calling me, by racking his gun, so I would answer the phone and you hear the clip of bullets being inserted into the gun. Very terrorizing for me. So then I had a bomb threat where when the police got to the source of the call, it turned out that he was using the caller ID spoofing, so that the source of the call, according to the police, showed up as my own cell phone, as if I had called from my cell phone to my landline, where I received the bomb threat. So basically, my ex-husband is using false victimization. He's saying that he's the victim, I'm making false allegations, and indeed he has a blog at a machete law firm in out of San Francisco, indeed saying that, you know, how false allegations of domestic violence, you know, are made in order to get more money out of in a divorce. So far, he's protected not only by his police department. No reports were taken when I tried to get him out of the house. Then I've tried to obtain protective orders, and then that's where I started getting into the judicial bias. Commissioner David Haight, who just received the 2008 California Family Law Judicial Officer of the Year, he tried to intervene from me trying to obtain an order of protection when I was escaping into Washington State for protection and living in a shelter there. So he called the judge up there, tried to prevent the judge from granting me the one-year protective order. And the Washington State Judicial Authority said, the judge said, Susan, you're dealing with small-town influence down there in Vallejo, California, and he granted me the one-year order,
right,
which was instantly overturned because I didn't have notice of a hearing. So that got overturned. But now what's happened in the family law case, the divorce has continued into its sixth year. I've lost over $112,000 trying to protect myself, which is a lot of my lifetime savings. And now it doesn't stop there. The Commissioner David Haight, who did not recuse himself, even though he has a close relationship with my ex-husband, he is threatening to sanction me for having obtained protective orders.
And on August 18th, when we were in court of 2008 in Solano County, he said in open court, and I have witnesses, he said that me having obtained protective orders has had a chilling effect on Mr. being able to become chief of police. So clearly there's favoritism, there's a lot of protection. I have no protection. I'm afraid to get another protective order. And it's really a very difficult situation. Meanwhile, I'm operating under, you know, the harassment, being a stalking victim. He's terrorizing me wherever I go. He just tracked me to Southern California last Monday, impersonating the security guards at my residence down in Southern California. So it's a real fight for survival right now with me.
Alexis, when you hear and you see stories like this, right from the aspect of the law enforcement involvement, not just the beat cop on the street, but we're talking about high-profile law enforcement, to the judicial, to the technology involved here, to dragging this out to, and I almost burst out laughing in disgust when someone is threatened with sanction for trying to get a protection order or order of protection because it may affect someone's job as the chief of police. Well, maybe that someone shouldn't be chief of police. This has to be a huge challenge, but yet a huge desire for you. And most victim advocates that I know will take the ball and run with this as much as they can, because we don't hear of a lot of these stories, but there's a lot of them going on.
Well, you know, Dana, and thank you, Susan. I have to say this over and over. Susan Rhodes is probably the most courageous victim I know. I have served other victims who have been in similar circumstances, but they're too afraid, and that's why nothing's changing. Susan, by her coming forward, is not only risking her life, but she's making it possible for victim advocates like me to speak out. Because if you don't have someone like her, we're basically talking about a ghost. And in this case, Susan has been through literally a hell that none of us even speak of, but thanks to her describing it as she has, when you're dealing with judicial bias because there's law enforcement involved who have such close relationships with judges and attorneys, as in her case, and then you have the high tech on top of it, almost impossible for her to garner support. And I learned this quickly. As soon as I came aboard in August of 2008, I reached out to everyone I knew, some close friends, folks that have helped me, folks that I believe owed me one, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They said, and I quote, this is advocates here in California and across the nation that claim to be experts in the matters of officer involved. Alexis, there is nothing we can do. If you can do it, great, but we cannot risk our relationship with law enforcement to assist this woman or anyone else. We'll give her a handbook. They can offer support by email. But as far as going to court with her, even representing her in a fashion like I do, where you actually go to court with her or, you know, advise her on what matters that she has pending, that, or, you know, possibilities of where she could be sheltered or anything else, there is not the same protections available to her that there is to an average domestic violence or stalking victim, because no one wants to shelter somebody that's officer involved. And those that do advocate for her will not do so publicly like I'm doing, because they're fearful that they're going to risk their reputation and their involvement and so forth with law enforcement be tarnished. And in essence, it's just unbelievable. I really don't know what else to say but to say that for this individual, for this commissioner, and for this position that she's in, to even be threatened with sanctions is not the first time. But it's amazing, because she's coming forward. Hopefully we'll see justice. But I'm almost at a loss for words, just because someone that's in a courthouse that's experiencing this and their own attorney won't advocate for them, I'm realizing, you know, hey, where's the help here?
Yeah.
But again, it has to do with that small, she says it best, that small-minded, small-town atmosphere that, you know, it's the good old boy network. And as much as I love my law enforcement folks, they do great work out there. Not everyone's bad. But again, this is an injustice that has to stop. And hopefully with Susan Rhodes speaking out, we will see justice and have some sort of checks and balances implemented so that more victims like her do in fact have justice, instead of those that just don't have officer involved, or what we say, the good old boy network in play.
Susan, how long were you married to this guy?
27 years.
27 years, that's a long time. And he's a police officer the whole time?
Yes.
It's difficult at best, when you look at the statistics, police officers and divorce and all this sort of stuff, but it, being in that dungeon of a marriage, and that's my term, not yours, where, you know, every so often the door may crack open and you see some light early on and you think things are great, then all of a sudden, bang, that door gets slammed on you again. To hear a gun racking over the telephone, to hear whatever, you know, it had to have been so difficult for you. What brought you to finally say enough is enough?
Well, I think that he wasn't stopping and nobody was listening to me, and he was trying to tell everyone that I was crazy. And even one of the victim advocates who was supposed to be in court with me the day that I had to describe the sexual assault, she left me a phone message and she said, "Susan, I believe you, but I've been told by higher-ups not to give you any help."
Wow.
And when I received that message, I knew how bad it was. And I knew that I really had hit this blue wall. And it was just a very difficult situation. I left my children. I left my community. I vacated everything. I just basically tried to disappear. But he's always found me. And that's the part that's so scary, is that even though, you know, he's remarried and his community is totally behind him, they don't know what's gone on, you know, in my situation.
There's a psychological aspect to this, Alexis. Alexis Moore is here from Survivors in Action, along with victim Susan Rhodes. Alexis, the psychological aspect, not only the terror, and we've talked on this program many times about the cycle of violence, more so fourfold for those involved with law enforcement, military, husbands, whatever, doesn't matter. But when you look at a case like this and you look at the male that just won't let go, and I think you've got a court case coming up, or Susan does, on April 2nd. Tell us a little bit about what your thoughts are on that husband that just is just obsessed, crazy, for lack of a better term.
And I hope it's okay to say, but I just figure that this is the best way of describing it. They're hell-bent.
Yeah.
It makes no difference if Susan drops everything. You know, I've had attorneys that I've canceled with that have met with Susan and I regarding her case who say it best. If she walks away, he's still going to stalk. It's a control issue, and whether it be that, you know, as they say in life, you know, this person is hell-bent, and in her case, it doesn't matter if she flees to Washington, when we've got Commissioner Haight making phone calls or you know, crossing state lines to reach out to those to say, listen, she's within my sphere of influence, do not issue this protective order, or if she's in California, this person is at risk, and this particular individual will not back down, and that's very common. And it's unfortunate, but oftentimes those that have been in the position of power, and I say this reluctantly because I do have relatives that are in law enforcement. They are some of the best people out there, and I respect law enforcement. So I want that all the listeners to know I'm not a quote, cop hater. But in this case, it's like many others. When you're dealing with folks that are in positions of power, whether it be law enforcement, attorneys, judges, or the like, private investigators, you do have a different mindset, and in the case of a high-tech stalker, he's gotten away with so much, and every time he does, it empowers this individual to do more, and the fact that the courts are enabling him, in my opinion, they're aiding and abetting his activities as well, and again, empowering him more. So the message is clear. Susan has no choice but to speak out, and hopefully tonight, someone out there listening, whether it be an attorney, a judge, attorney general, whomever it may be, may say, you know what, I have other cases like this, and hopefully victims who are experiencing the same thing will contact her or myself via Survivors in Action, and we can unite to make something happen, some change, and be a catalyst for change, because these sorts of situations are not going to go away. And in Susan's case, because she is speaking out, and as I promised her back in August of 2008, I will not let any of this activity go in vain. Her speaking out, her courage and strength will definitely live on, and we are going to work very hard together to be sure that this doesn't happen to someone else, at least here in California. And I'm saying this as a promise, and I keep my promises.
Absolutely. Susan, as a victim of stalking, this is something that I'm sure you phone the police. You know, what do most people do when they're afraid? They phone the police. But in a situation like this, when you're person that is allegedly stalking you is the police. How difficult is that for you? I know that's an easy answer for you, but it's an answer that a lot of my listeners need to hear, because they're still sitting back kind of with their mouths open right now saying, oh, wow.
Well, I've filed about, I think, 16 police reports right now, and each police report encompasses maybe anywhere from two incidences to maybe 50 or to 100 incidences. So basically, the longer it goes on, the less likelihood that you are going to get a police response, because they all say, well, gee, if he was really, you know, if we could prove anything, we would have had him arrested. So the longer it goes on, the less credibility the victim has. And, you know, I really blame the courts and the failure of our judicial system, you know, because California ruled that I was a victim of crime. That was as a result of the sexual assault from the domestic violence. But then the judicial, the officer and the, you know, Commissioner Haight says, but there was no domestic violence. So that's in light of all the hospital reports, statements from the state disability doctor, domestic violence counselor, my victim of crime status. The commissioner still says there's no domestic violence. And I was actually okay at the time that that ruling came down, because I thought, well, maybe that would help my stalker stop and it would give him what he wanted. You know, but now that the court has turned that around and they're going to sanction me for trying to protect myself, that there's just something really wrong with our system. And I used to teach government, senior government in high school, and I have never experienced this type of corruption and collusion and, you know, abuse of power, abuse of authority. I feel sorry for every woman or other person who's experienced this, and I really would hope that as listeners are out there, if they have other situations involving officer-involved domestic violence, which is about 40% compared to about 10% in our general population, I would encourage them to come forward and contact me through Alexis Moore of Survivors in Action, so that we can start to gather more information and try to give each other some support.
Alexis, the media, you have to get the word out the best you can. We're doing what we can here. But the media, have they looked at your story?
You know, they have. Often, like everything else, it just takes time. With these sorts of cases, when you have a victim like Susan that is courageous and willing to come up and come forward rather and speak, it's just making sure that we stay in touch and that we encourage and we ask that the media continue to follow up. Because, again, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot for this person, like Susan or anyone else, to lose courage. And something I've learned from Susan, however, since August, she has never swayed in her testimony. She's never lost hope. This woman is definitely interested in telling her story. And whether it be right here locally in Sacramento, California, or as we are this evening in the Canadian radio show, it's very important that if you are out there and you're in need of help, that you do come forward. And that you realize that by coming forward, you're allowing others to step in and to help you. Because we can't help you unless we know who you are. And I do have faith. I have faith in our justice system. I have faith in law enforcement. And I do believe that what's right will happen. But it's not going to be easy. And that old saying about patience and persistence in this matter, I tell Susan this every time we speak. We've got to be patient as well as persistent, and good will come. And I believe that wholeheartedly.
The wonderful thing about my program is that it goes across the world, a big listenership in the United States and Canada. And these sorts of stories, although we don't hear a lot about them, Susan, if I was to ask you, and I know it's difficult for you right now, but it's always so impressive to me on how victims like yourself can use the difficulty that you're going through right now as a strength catalyst to help others. If you were able to spend the next minute and give some advice to a young victim or an older victim or a victim of stalking, a victim in a domestic situation where their husband is a law enforcement officer or someone in a position of power like that, what would that be?
I think one key to it is documentation. I have audio recordings of the gun racking phone calls and other phone calls using my son's baby name and other things. And documenting that evidence, I'm now able to get it onto audio files on my computer to email it out. I think also having witnesses give statements and make statements, like right now I'm getting oath statements from the security guards that experienced this caller ID spoofing, because those kinds of things will give credibility to your story. I never should victims give up hope. They should always still continue to reach out, even though it seems as if sometimes it feels so hopeless. I think Alexis Moore has given me all the hope in the world, and it's the first time with all my cries for help that I feel like my cries for help have not gone on deaf ears. So finally I've connected with someone who understands the high-tech stalking and so on. And I think with officer-involved domestic violence, you have to sometimes go above where the problem is. You have to understand that the internal investigations within police departments are always going to, well, not always, but often favor, you know, the officer, to protect the officer and to protect the department. They keep having to go higher up and higher up. And I would encourage victims to even go to the FBI office if that's what they feel like they need to do, to always have a victim advocate present with them, have a video recorder to take pictures. You need pictures taken of any evidence. You need audios. You need to carry with you devices where you can tape and audio anything that might happen. Always call 911 if you feel threatened, so that evidence is preserved that way. I know in Washington State we lost Crystal Judson. She was murdered by her chief of police husband. At that time, nobody thought that this kind of thing could ever happen, but it did, and it really opened eyes. But we need a lot more to happen within the United States on this matter.
Alexis, I'll give you the final word.
Well, again, Dana, thank you so much for having us. And Susan, always, you know that you definitely, I admire you and your courage. And I hope this evening those of you that are listening that are victims of abuse or stalking will reach out for help. Do not be ashamed. There are advocates out there like myself who believe in you and who will advocate for you no matter what. And what I mean by that is, no matter what position you're in or who you're married to or who you live with or who is abusing you, you do have a voice. And I can tell you for sure that if Susan Rhodes can come forward, you definitely can come forward, and there's no reason to live or to work in fear. And that's my final closing statement for this evening.
All right. I will stay in touch, ladies. Feel free to contact me anytime. It's a story that needs more follow-up and needs to be told, and I thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right. We'll be back in just a minute with a former prosecutor, author, victims advocate, one of the most popular guests on my program, Wendy Murphy, and we're going to talk about male victims. We're going to talk a little bit about the Anthony case and that. You are listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Thank you.
All right, we're back. It wouldn't be a Dana Pretzer show without at least being able to talk a little bit about the Anthony case. And I thought there's no better person to bring on to talk about that. And another one of these crazy school teachers, in this case Christine McCollum, than Wendy Murphy. You know Wendy is the author of the best-selling book, Injustice for Some. She's a law professor. She's a former DA, victims advocate, you name it. One of the most popular guests on the program. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Dana. Good to be with you.
My commentary on the webpage tomorrow will talk about George Anthony and what's gone on with him. I'm curious, with the way that this story is going, all of a sudden the suicide threat by the grandfather, George Anthony, shouldn't be a shock to anyone. However, the way I think the media is covering it somewhat, it should be a shock to some people. That's just my opinion. I'm really curious on what you have to say.
Well, you know, I have a lot of thoughts. The first is that it's hard to be suspicious when somebody appears to attempt suicide, because it's serious. I mean, even the worst of the worst human beings on the planet, have value, I guess, and he's not even charged. So, you know, my heart, first reaction was to feel for him. But I'm also, I've been around long enough that I also had a part of my brain saying, well, wait a minute, this may not even be real.
Yeah.
And I continue to wonder today if there isn't a risk that this is a bit of a hoax. And let me explain why. In almost any high-profile case, in my experience doing TV, you know, for the past 10 years plus and being a prosecutor for 20, the attempt to manipulate public opinion in a high-profile case by the defendant or people on his behalf or on her behalf is just, it's so common that it is sometimes the first thing I assume that I want to rule it out. And if there really is a suicide attempt, you know, then you might start to feel better, ask other kinds of questions. There's also the point, by the way, that in my experience as a prosecutor, someone who tries to commit suicide usually is doing it because they feel guilty about something. And again, that doesn't really evoke sympathy for me. If anything, I use it as evidence in my case to prove a kind of consciousness of guilt. Now, going back to the first point, though, is this a hoax? Who knows?
Yeah.
There have been reports that when he got to the hotel where he was reportedly going to try to take his own life, he ordered pizza and had a six-pack of beer. Now, I don't know what the parameters are around what a non-hoax suicide attempt looks like versus a real one. I think people can have cries for help that don't quite look like legitimate suicide efforts, and yet that doesn't mean they're not despondent.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know that I would be hungry for pizza if I were about to take my own life.
Yeah.
So all those kind of questions aside, there's also just a very real possibility in any case that it's done for show. There's been an awful lot of show stuff going on in this case since the beginning. Efforts to do a dog and pony show to distract us from paying attention to the really strong evidence and trying to generate sympathy as part of the dog and pony show tactic we've seen in other cases, a la Michael Jackson. I write all about this in my book when he was, you'll recall this, Dana, he was walking around outside the courthouse in his pajamas doing the Thorazine shuffle, acting like he had a mental problem.
Yep.
There's no question in my mind that that was part of the show designed to provoke people and make us feel bad for him. Oh, the poor guy, he's not so much evil. He's not, trying to rape children. He's just sick. I think that was quite deliberate. The guy isn't sick so much as slick. And so if there's a reason why George Anthony might want to create a wall of sympathy around him, I don't think there's any hope of creating sympathy around Casey.
Yeah.
It might be for a couple of reasons, including that he wants an immunity deal.
Yeah.
And he hasn't gotten one yet. Now, my response back to him is, stop with the nonsense. Stop asking for immunity. If the real reason you may feel bad is because you know things, I don't think he killed the child, but
no.
Let's say he knows things and it's eating him up inside in a true, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle style or Shakespearean style, it's just eating him up inside and he's driving himself crazy, then the only answer is, tell the truth, George. Tell what you know.
Yeah.
Stop with the nonsense. Stop with the suicide threats. Just tell what you know and stop eating, letting this stuff eat you up inside. Because if you've got stress over whether you should be helping your daughter avoid a first-degree murder conviction or helping protect your grandchild's quest for justice, though she's not even alive anymore, you want to do the right thing for two people, and you can't. And you want us to feel bad for you because you can't figure out how to do the right thing, forget about it. Just do the right thing. The right thing is stand up for the child. She's got nothing. No voice. She's dead. Speak for the child. Tell the truth, and that will fix your problems, George. That's what I said to him the other night on Jane Velez Mitchell's show, and that's what I think, if he does feel despondent, that's what I think he should do.
I think the perception angle is dead on. When you have a client supposedly is going to take his life, and before you even find him, Geraldo has got the story, and the lawyer is being booked on the show to talk about it. You got to look at that public perception angle. And remember the old monster Wendy, Vinny the Chin in New York, walked
yep.
around in his bedroom slippers and his pajamas down the streets of New York to make himself look crazy?
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know.
In the Skakel case, you remember the Kennedy yep. cousin there.
Absolutely.
The Skakel father knew an awful lot of stuff. They tried to get him to testify from Florida. He started acting like he was mentally ill, belly bumping people in the courtroom and so forth. And he was perfectly sane. No, it's not a new trick.
No.
But, you know, you don't want to be too cavalier about it. It's possible that somebody is doing this for show. It's also possible the guy feels despondent. My opinion is, I don't care about either of those things, because the guy's got, we've got to squeeze this man. George knows something more than what he's telling. He has submitted a little bit, in terms of cooperating, submitted a little bit of evidence, but he has since then, since his first round of conversations with the cops, refused to cooperate, refuses to sit for a polygraph. Come on, you know? Please, I don't care. Squeeze this man, as far as I'm concerned, squeeze him with any amount of heat and pressure you can bring to bear and hope that a little bit of the truth comes out of him.
Yeah, so true. I read an article the other day by yours truly, I mean you, male abuse victims suffer from crime and stereotypes, and here we go, another fifth grade teacher, Christine McCollum. What's going on, Wendy, with this?
Well, thanks for mentioning that. You know, I write a regular column for the Patriot Ledger newspaper, which is also syndicated through the Gatehouse News Service, so it appears in a bunch of newspapers, mostly on the East Coast, but sometimes it gets picked up nationally. And one of my recent columns, as you mentioned, deals with this issue of female adult teacher abuse of 12, 13, 14-year-old boy students. And one of the things I take on in the article, in particular, deals with a new case in Massachusetts, Christine McCollum, who targeted a motherless 12-year-old child, ingratiated herself into the family, and then when he was 13, began to rape him and literally had her way with him something like 300 times over the course of 18 months.
Jeez.
Now, you know, too often, and indeed it was reported locally here, things, you know, responsible news reporters saying things like, this was hot and steamy. You know, it isn't. It's child abuse, period. And we sometimes forget that, although a boy, and this is what I write in my article, because it's hard, you have to be delicate here, although a boy gets all tingly during an act of abuse in ways that we don't understand or feel the same way about when it's a girl as the victim of a male teacher abuse, just because it feels tingly in the boy's parts doesn't mean it's good for him, doesn't mean he's not being harmed and injured and exploited and abused. And even if he doesn't appreciate it, we adults do, and we have to, you know, stand in his shoes and not high-five the kid. And one of the things I say to people is, look, if you look at the statistics on boys who are abused by adult women in terms of how they function as adults, they're a mess. They have PTSD, they have drug and alcohol problems, they often have difficulties with intimate relationships, because when they get older, they start to understand what it means to be sexually exploited. But it's hard to fix their brain that was injured so many years earlier, because that brain doesn't exist anymore. And we have to understand trauma with due respect for how difficult it can be for boys, because we're not even letting them feel the pain that they might be feeling, because we keep saying, oh, isn't that good? Aren't you lucky? If a boy does feel exploited, we don't even let them say it because we're too busy high-fiving them. We need to stop that, because it's hurting boys, particularly when they become men and then become fathers themselves and so forth. And the other thing I like to do is to say to folks, and I write this in my piece, instead of saying, well, if it feels good, it must be good for them, why don't we compare it to how we think about boys who drink beer underage and then drive fast? We know that feels tingly, too. But my God, we don't say, go for it, son. Go ahead, little Johnny. We know that buzz you get from a beer makes you feel good, so go for it. And we certainly don't high-five them when they then drive fast, even though they like that feeling, too. In other words, just because the kids like it doesn't mean it's good for them, and adults have to stop thinking about male child sex abuse as an act of sex, stop looking at the act through what I call the lens of an orgasm, and start to think about what it means to be exploited when you're a kid, male or female, because boys need us to stop eroticizing the harm that they suffer. They're really going through a tough time, even though they might not see it.
We're down to about 3 minutes, Wendy, but you and I have talked about this before with other cases, sadly, female teachers on male students, but this predatory aspect of these teachers, and they seem to still be out there. The system still seems to be failing the student. What can we do? What can the media do as far as covering these stories go? Because it is the feel-good kind of story. Hey, you know, I wished I was that kid when I was going to school, all that kind of crap, and the big picture isn't getting out there.
Yeah, well, one thing we all have to do is stop using erotic language to talk about any kind of sexual abuse. We eroticize sexual violence often passively. We're not trying to be mean or, you know, make it seem light. but we do it because we're so comfortable. That's the thing that feels less scary to us. We have to stop that. We have to call it what it is. We have to use the harsh language. Yes, it's going to make us uncomfortable, but that's because of the nature of the act, you know, and we have to get outside our comfort zone and talking about what it is to be a male victim of abuse in particular, but even for females, we have to stop using erotic language and pretending that just because it involves sexual behavior that means it's sometimes pleasurable. It isn't. Being exploited, being sexually abused is never pleasurable, period, no matter what the parts are like. So our language matters. The other thing in terms of predatory teachers is we have to start looking at the warning signs better, and we have to start screening teachers better. In other words, we should be using psychological screening tools to figure out whether the teachers we're hiring have personality disorders. Very often, we're saying after the fact, oh, you know, she was crazy. Oh, that teacher, well, she had mental problems. Well, you know, if we started asking those questions before the fact, they'd never be allowed to get that close to kids. And the really important thing we need to do is to start recognizing the warning signs, the red flags, the times when teachers get a little bit too close to little Johnny or little Susie. Instead of saying, well, isn't that teacher nice? Isn't it nice that teacher's taking the extra step, getting a little closer to my kid or that kid next door? Isn't that nice that that female teacher latched on to this boy because he doesn't have a mother? Boy, isn't she sweet? Isn't she generous? We have to say sometimes, maybe that's a warning sign. Maybe that's a red flag. Maybe that's some smoke that might someday turn to the flames of sexual abuse. Let's stop waiting until 300 rapes have occurred before we step in and say, wait a minute now, something doesn't look right here. We have to recognize the warning signs and take swift action, getting rid of the bad teachers as soon as we can, because even one rape of even one child is way too much damage.
Absolutely. Wendy, thank you.
My pleasure, Dana. Take care.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy. And yeah, you know, when you're in a position of trust and you can rape a child 300 times, there should be 300 life sentences for that individual. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. A recent Women in Crime article, and of course I encourage you all to go to the Women in Crime blog. We have a link in the show notes for it, says this. On December 28, 2008, at around 12:30 a.m., Officer Sombrowski stopped 16-year-old Jonathan Belton in Oak Park, Michigan, for an equipment violation. Belton reportedly had a criminal history for an assault on a public school officer, as well as illegally carrying a concealed gun. During the traffic stop, Sombrowski discovered that the teen was driving without a driver's license. Belton told Sombrowski that he had a parent or guardian at a nearby complex, and then tragedy struck shortly after that. I thought I'd bring on the author of that article. It's a wonderful article, and again, I remind you all to go to the Women in Crime blog to read more. Donna Pendergast is a murder prosecutor. I don't think you can get much more direct than that, and she writes the article, and it talks about the officer that was killed in this situation, obviously. Hi, Donna. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Dana. Glad to be here.
These stories are so tragic. This is one in however many that are happening all the time. But in this particular situation, and what caught my eye, and we'll get into that a little bit later, is the aspect of the age. And I'm looking at a picture of Belton. Nice-looking young guy, and all of a sudden age plays into a factor in some jurisdictions. Well, he's young and all this sort of stuff. And I am a huge proponent of, I don't give a darn how old they are. If you do the crime, you do the time. There's that responsibility aspect. But anyway, what brought you to write this article?
Well, you know, Dana, I've been a prosecutor for 22 years, and I've prosecuted personally two separate cases when I was a prosecutor in Detroit where a police officer was killed in the line of duty. They're always devastating, you know, cases to the law enforcement community. In this case, once again, the jurisdiction where it occurred, I was actually a prosecutor in that jurisdiction for 15 years. So I have, although I didn't know Officer Sombrowski, I have a great many friends on that police department. And when I read this article, when it was breaking news, I should say, on the internet, it was just like, oh, not again.
Yeah.
And especially, I live in the community, the county where it happened. I know officers from that department, and having personally been involved in two separate cases of this sort, once again, it just profoundly affected me, and I was struck by the senselessness of all of it.
The officer, Mason Samborski, was on the job. This started with a traffic stop, as many officer-involved killings do. Domestic disputes, traffic stops are usually two of the big ones. Let's get into the facts here a little bit. What happened?
Well, Officer Samborski stopped this 16-year-old individual, Mr. Belton, for an equipment violation. What exactly that was has not been made clear through the media reports. However, when he did stop him, it became apparent to the officer that he was an unlicensed driver. He never had a license. What's so really tragic about this case is, from all accounts, it appears that Officer Samborski was trying to help this kid.
Yeah.
Rather than haul him into the police station, he was looking for a parent or guardian to release him to. And in the effort of doing that, he took him to an apartment complex where Mr. Belton represented his mother was. And when Officer Samborski got there, it all started to unravel. After Samborski put him in the back of the patrol car, Belton got a quick call in to a girl he knew at this apartment complex. He had actually been there earlier in the evening and said, "Pretend you're my mother." She said, "That's not going to work. I can pretend I'm your sister." So they got to the complex, and the girl actually went down to the door of the apartment complex, the main doors coming in, to let them in. While they were at the doors, she opened the door to the apartment building itself, and Officer Samborski started asking a few more questions, and all of a sudden started to realize that this was all a ruse. Belton apparently didn't want to be taken into custody, so he broke away from Officer Samborski, ran to the second floor of the building with Samborski in pursuit, then ran back down some steps. They actually tumbled down them together, and at some point, obviously, Mr. Belton got Officer Samborski's gun and shot him one time in the head.
You talk about in the article, as far as motivation goes, although it's not important for a prosecutor to prove motivation, why, when all you have is just a no driver's license, obviously there was a gun involved and, you know, maybe some other felonies that we don't know about, but why shoot the officer? You know, what's going on here? And that's a big question in these cases.
You know, motivation doesn't have to be proven by the prosecutor, and, you know, you can ask yourself why until the cows come home. The unfortunate truth in cases like this is sometimes there is no why, other than a juvenile subculture of violence,
yeah,
and violence and disrespect for authority. You know, I don't want to date myself here, but back 30 years ago when I was in high school, you know, if there was going to be some sort of trouble, it certainly didn't involve guns, but I don't know what it is today. I don't know if it's, you know, the video games. I've also done a blog on that, but there does seem to be a subculture of juvenile violence that was, you know, brought up at the funeral, where there is a basic disrespect for authority, and certainly a they've been desensitized, the juveniles have, as to, you know, the permanent effects of this. I mean, you shoot a police officer in the head over, a traffic stop that at best you're going to be hauled into the station and released to a parent. It's just, it boggles the mind. That's all I can say.
Prosecutor Donna Pendergast is here, and we're talking about the death of Officer Samborski in Oak Park, Michigan. I've talked about it before, and I think even you and I have talked about it. We've done many shows on what's called, I call accountability and the lack thereof nowadays, especially with the juveniles, the young persons, because they just know they're going to get away with it. This is a huge, in the sick, twisted culture, badge of honor for these young punks to take out a cop. And it just isn't the old days. And I think you said that very well, where if you're even going to have a fist fight, you go out and you duke it out and that was it. Nowadays, you go out and have a fist fight, somebody's got a knife or a gun, and they're going to kill you. They'll stab you. They'll do whatever. Let's talk about, Donna, the courts and the difference between how these juveniles are treated to the system and that whole aspect of no accountability. At least that's my belief.
Well, in this case, well, I should say in any case in Oakland County, Michigan, where the offense occurred, prosecutors have, you know, a decision to make whether or not this individual is going to be charged as an adult. And in they have 5 days to make that decision. They can hold the juvenile for 5 days. In this case, there was a change in administration the first of the year. So when this was all going on, there was a new prosecutor coming in. So the prosecutors took the 5 days that they were entitled to, but when the new prosecutor, who was a former judge, came in, they came out with a decision, which I knew they were going to, and that was to charge him as an adult. Mm-hmm. And in a case like this, I don't think you have any choice but to charge. I mean, when you have such a callous disregard for human life and such a disrespect for authority, you've got to charge somebody like this as an adult. But you know what was very telling, Dana, was one of the first media reports I saw was the mother of this juvenile, you know, out there. And I understand a mother's a mother, but out there saying, you know, he was a good kid.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he went to church and this and that. And
sure.
I thought, you know what, Mom? You gave up your right to say how good of a kid he was the moment he pulled that trigger.
Absolutely.
And, you know, basically he gave up his childhood when he fired a gun at a police officer's head.
The article ends, "Rest in peace, Officer Mason Samborski. Your honor, courage, and sacrifice will be remembered forever." End of watch, December 28th, 2008. Donna, an excellent article. It just shows how difficult that job is when you're out there as law enforcement. A simple traffic stop can turn into tragedy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye. And, you know, it just breaks my heart every time I hear a story like this. And I don't know. Let's hope that there's a good, strong conviction and a nice, long life sentence. Because in the United States, a life sentence usually means a life sentence. That's it. That's tonight's show. My name's Dana Pretzer. You can check out the webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can hear the show live. You can listen to podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, whatever you like. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you again real soon.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.